A legend has it that an army of King Håkon of Norway, intent on conquering the Scots, landed at the coast of Largs at night to surprise the sleeping Scottish clansmen. In order to move more stealthily under the cover of darkness, the Norsemen removed their footwear. As they drew near to the Scots, it wasn't the only thing hiding under the cover of darkness, for one of Håkon's men, unfortunately, stepped on one of these spiny little defenders and shrieked out in pain, alerting the clansmen of the advancing Norsemen. Needless to say, the Scots won the day. So goes the legend behind the Scottish fondness for thistles. By the 13th century, the Scandinavians and the Celts had been interacting in a variety of ways. For several hundred years, was it always about battles and grubbing for treasure? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
When and how did the Scandinavians and the Irish and the Scots first come into contact? What part did religion play in the confrontations? And what accounts do we have of them? Our guest is Thomas Dubois, professor in the Department of Scandinavian Studies at the UW-Madison.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
Hello, I'm so glad to be here. I've loved your program and love to be part of it.
This whole area seems to invite a question as to what's folklore and what's fact. When you're talking about Vikings and you're talking about these early pillaging and all that, it's kind of hard to tell. Like even in the example that Norman just read about the thistle, you know, where it's coming from and how to look at it. Give us some background here so that as we talk about it, we know what we're dealing with.
Well, anyone who deals with the Middle Ages knows that there is no such thing as history. There's only story. And how we understand story, its historicity or how closely it's based on historical events that actually happened is always an issue of tremendous debate. But one of the interesting things about 20th century scholarship is that more and more we know a lot about this very long period from, let's say, the 8th century right through to the time of Håkon that you were talking about. In terms of archaeology gives us another snapshot of what actually happened. And on the basis of that material, we can often see that the stories that we have, stories about conflict, about enemies, about groups defeating each other and then wiping them off the land and Scotland staying Scottish, Norway staying Norwegian, really have very little to do with what actually happened. And in fact, there was a much more complex meeting of cultures, sharing of ideas, and influence that went in both directions over a number of centuries.
And speaking of latter-day research techniques, we also have, I guess, genetic information that says that they also did spend a lot of time making love and not war.
Absolutely. And we can look at, for instance, Iceland, which is the kind of the stepchild of both the Celtic world and the Scandinavian world. And you can look at the genetic material of ordinary Icelanders today and see that about a third of that genome comes from the British Isles.
Really?
So that's a lot of intermarriage.
It is.
And Icelanders will say, yes, we stole women from the Irish.
But
in fact, the sagas even and many of the other materials we have indicate that it wasn't always against people's wills, that people met each other and they fell in love and they actually created a new culture, which was a hybrid culture.
So if we go back to what you said, the 8th century is about when we start. And this is before we have places like Scotland and Ireland and so on. Right. Give us the background here in terms of, you know, what kinds of peoples are we dealing with?
Well, we can talk linguistically about two major groups. In the British Isles, we can talk about Celtic speakers, the speakers of what are today considered Scots Gaelic and Irish Gaelic. And we can also speak about the Welsh, but let's talk mostly about the Irish and the Scots because that's important. They had a particular culture. And then up in Scandinavia, we had a Germanic language family that spoke what was called the Northern Tongue, which we now call Old Norse, and was distantly related to English. And those two groups had linguistic commonalities, but in terms of social structure, within, for instance, Ireland, there was anywhere up to we now think archaeologically and in terms of historical records, 150 different kingdoms on the island of Ireland. Some of those kingdoms as small as, for instance, Madison or Oshkosh, but they were very much kingdoms with their own traditions, their own royal lines, and really importantly, their own court poets, that bards, or the Irish word was filí, who recorded in poetry the great deeds of the kingdom and talked about the great battles and wrote elegies about the dying of kings. So we really had these tiny kingdoms that fought against each other constantly and that lived in a very tiny, intimate kind of a way. So a kingdom of 100, 200 people with a king and some farming, some slaves, and also some aristocrats, but a very small little world. And these mutually exclusive but interacting units also existed in Scandinavia. So it was the same kind of fragmented small kingdom world. And then what we have happening in about the time that the Viking Age begins, or in the 8th century, is a consolidation process where those kingdoms are starting to be taken over and getting bigger. And then that comes to, with the Vikings, to Scandinavia, to the British Isles.
Can you give me a definition of a Viking and the difference between a Viking and a Norseman? And
yeah, that's an interesting issue in itself. Viking is a term that probably, the Old Norse term is vikingur, for it, and they were, that means a person in a harbor, because they were pirates, essentially. They would wait for trading boats to come by, and they would waylay them and grab their stuff and bring them home, because part of what this ancient society was about was praising the king, but also having treasures that you could give to your noblemen or your soldiers so that they would have loyalty towards the king. And so they were constantly in need of new treasure, and they would grab this from merchant ships, and they would distribute that out. So that's what the term Viking means. And when the Vikings first appear on the stage in the British Isles, they're definitely raiders of that sort. They're attacking monasteries, because little monasteries don't have much defense, and they're grabbing stuff to take home. And in fact, there's a wonderful example of a holy reliquary where the Vikings stole that. They dumped out the holy bones that were in there, and the guy scratched his name, Olaf, on the bottom of it and gave it as a treasure to a friend.
Under new management.
It exists today in the National Museum at Copenhagen. But at the same time, there really was a much broader migration of settlers from Scandinavia into the British Isles. These may have been raiders at the start, but they came with families eventually, and they put down roots in the British Isles, in the islands to the west of Scotland, Hebrides and Orkneys, and also on the west coast of Scotland, and then in various places in Ireland. In fact, places that are today cities like Dublin and Wexford, Waterford and Cork and Limerick, all were Viking settlements. So they started to put down roots. And that implies a very different meaning of Vikings, a Viking society that's in fact families and is replicating a Scandinavian way of life within this new place.
But the Vikings have this reputation for being really great at adapting to their surroundings and in effect kind of absorbing themselves into them. But the Irish, from what, the early 5th century, thanks to St. Patrick and some others, was Christian, whereas the Vikings coming down for a couple hundred years after that are not, right?
Well, yes, but the Irish were Christian in a very particular kind of way, which is really interesting to look at. Patrick comes from Roman Britain to Ireland, and what he builds in Ireland in the 5th century is a very Celtic form of Christianity. In this society where we have these tiny kingdoms and chieftains and court poets singing their praises, Patrick realizes that he can't create the administrative structure that happened in Rome, with dioceses and so forth. But instead, he creates a system of what we call permeable monastic units, or monasticism that's permeable, so that there are monasteries in which often a chieftain or a chieftain's son is the head. And these are places that become mini kingdoms in themselves, and celebrate the same kind of heroic past and heroic history that we have having taken place in the kingdoms.
But we think of kingdoms as having armies, and we think of monasteries as not having defense.
Well, that's where things get interesting, too, in the Celtic world, because we know one of the great patrons of Irish and also Scottish Christianity, St. Columba or Columbkill, is from a royal family in northern Ireland, the O'Neill clan. And he gets into a fight with another abbot of another monastery, St. Finian, over a psalter. So I don't know if you know that story.
No.
But, Cullum spends a year very carefully copying the contents of a psalter that he borrows from St. Finian. And then after he's done, he gives back the original to St. Finian. And Finian says, okay, now give me the copy as well.
Why?
Because, he says, it was my book, therefore I own the copy as well. And as you're indicating, Emily, St. Columba says, I just did all this work. This is mine. And it goes to through various kind of litigation. And in the end, the decision is that a calf belongs to a cow. Therefore, the copy of the Psalter belongs to St.
Interesting. Interesting
so,
logic. Yeah,
so, interesting logic, right? That's how legal things tend to be. But,
so an early example of intellectual property dispute.
Exactly. Yeah. And what comes out of that is St. Columba is not happy about that. So he actually stages a battle against St. Finian, and hundreds of people die. So there were military presences to these monasticisms. And in fact, that kills so many people that they decide to, in the end, that Columba can no longer stay in Ireland, and he's exiled to Scotland, which is how he gets there.
And with the Vikings that attacked monasteries, what particular kind of wealth were they after?
Well, one of the things that is happening in these monasteries is that people are giving gifts out of their excess wealth to thank saints for miracles or to buy good graces in heaven or to get out of purgatory, which in all indications is an Irish invention that comes into the wider Christianity. So there are these treasures being amassed, metal things, beautiful reliquaries, candlesticks, things made out of precious metals, books that are beautifully illuminated with wonderful book covers. And these are treasures that the Vikings use as gifts to each other. They don't originally understand necessarily what they're all about, but they're pretty and they're valuable, and they can be given as gifts. And so they get stolen for that reason.
And do they take slaves as well?
They take slaves. In fact, Dublin developed as one of the most important slave centers in all of Northern Europe. And it, clearly there were slaves coming through the Dublin market that were from as far away as Russia, and they were being sold broadly.
This sounds like pretty one-sided relationship, though, because here the peace-loving Irish in their monasteries, and I assume some, you know, these scattered farms and these small kingdoms.
Yeah.
On the one hand, and then I get the impression they're staying put. I've never heard of a raid where the Irish go up to Norway and grab stuff.
Right.
So it's those pesky Vikings starting all this.
Well, clearly there is this process of expansion, population expansion from Scandinavia. And no one's quite sure why that happens. It seems to be driven by changes in the climate, a higher population in Scandinavia and not enough land. And it seems to come from the places where there's least amount of extra land. So Norway in particular, where only 3% of modern Norway is tillable. So there's a lot of people hugging the coast and living on very small plots. And a lot of them are the ones that actually start up to look for new lands in the British Isles.
So they're actually interested in settling, in other words, not just a grab and run, but they're actually looking to expand the Norwegian, I think it's too early to call it an empire, I guess, but the Norwegian reach.
Well, they're going on their own. Yeah, I don't think they have I think one of the important things to realize is that in this kind of stateless society at the early, there's really no thought about something that we would call Norway or even something that we would call Ireland. Everyone is thinking on a much more parochial level about their own family line or their own monastery and what they can do, where they can go to make a living. And it looks to us in hindsight like the movement of nations, but it's really the movement of individuals.
Every man for himself.
And is it mostly younger sons?
That clearly seems to be the case, that we have younger sons or excess males leaving with their families. But in the saga accounts that we have, of course, you emphasize that your ancestors were great men and that they weren't no goods who left for no reason, but that they had high connections back home. So we do have also accounts of first sons or people leaving Norway because they're feeling the pressure of the consolidation there, that they're losing rights within Norway that they think that they can recoup in the new settlements.
And is there violence for violence's sake? I mean, the stereotype of the Vikings is that they plundered and pillaged and raped and looted just for the sake of it, partly, not just to go home with some treasures, but because they were fairly bloodthirsty. True or not true?
Well, it's really clear that early medieval society was pretty violent, that there was in a stateless society, you create your own safety. And either you attack the neighbor or they attack you. And we have lots of skeletal remains among the Irish as well as among the Scandinavians in Ireland that show that these guys had a lot of wounds over their careers. And you can look at the ossifications in their skeletons and so forth and say, this guy must have been in a lot of pain when he finally died at age 40. So that kind of thing did happen, and that's no doubt. But in the poetry, of course, you glorify that violence because that was the role of the court poet. And it's important to read that kind of material with a kind of grain of salt because certainly there were, I'm sure, a lot of Scandinavians who were very peace-loving, as there were lots of Irish who simply wanted to grow their crops. There weren't potatoes yet, but grow their crops and have their families and live their life.
Well, that sounds wonderful, but once you have these Scandinavians coming down into your neighborhood, and it's not as if Ireland has lots and lots of tillable land, isn't there some resentment there? And wouldn't you expect that there would be some attempt to reject, to repulse these interlopers?
Oh, absolutely. There's tremendous anger. And part of that is because everybody had their small kingdoms, and those were really important. And if somebody moves in to even a small amount of land, if your kingdom is only the size of Madison, you know, that's their little place is half your kingdom. So there certainly is a lot of resistance, and we have that discourse really early on. But in reality, over the course of a generation or two, you start to get to know each other, and these populations are small, and they start to fall in love, or they start to marry each other for alliance sake, and you begin to have a new kind of a society created.
So there's no organized influx or no organized resistance.
Exactly. And that's one of the things to keep in mind about the process, that it's very small kingdoms thinking about themselves. And I always tell my students that it's kind of like the early stages in playing the game of Risk, which I love to play with my kids. And it's Risk takes a really long time to play. But if you know that game, it's got kind of a quasi-realistic map of the world. And at the beginning of the game, you're given really small kingdoms that are scattered, and you start to have to consolidate them. And you do that by fighting your neighbors and taking over things. And one round you fight them, and the next and get some ground, but the next round they fight you and get some ground. And that early stage works in a very kind of equal way until you get to a kind of tipping point, if you remember playing the game, where one guy gets big enough that he owns a whole territory and then suddenly has a lot more power. And that's a process that happens in the British Isles and in Scandinavia around the year 1000, and that's where you begin to get this very different kind of a framework. And you can start to talk about national prerogatives or nations. But before that, you're really talking about small, feuding, alliance-making little entities.
So let's say in England, would it be Alfred, the great kind of
unifier there? Well, Alfred the Great, of course, brings us into the Anglo-Saxon world.
Right.
And certainly he is one of the consolidators there in England. But in the Scandinavian world, we often talk about Harald Finnhair, the guy who...
They had great names, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Bluetooth is another favorite of mine.
Yeah, that he would not wash his hair cut his hair until he had united all of Norway. So he's aiming at this, putting all these small kingdoms under him, as it said. They are subjugated to his rule. And in Ireland, you have the development of something that's called the High Kingship, which is an attempt to muster all these small kingdoms into, at first, some very large subsets like Connacht and Ulster and Leinster and Munster, but then eventually those are also being merged into a overall Ireland with a high king.
And what's going on in Scotland all this time? It's somewhat different, isn't it?
Scotland is really interesting because it's a much more of a interface between the Scandinavian world and the Celtic and what's going on in England. So you have portions of what we call today Scotland that are part of the Viking world and that are part of the broader Norway as it develops, like the Orkney Islands, that in fact don't become part of Scotland until 1469, so really very late. And then you have other parts that are gradually being pulled into what's developing as England, and then you have parts that are setting themselves up as a kind of independent Scotland with its own identity.
You've mentioned a couple different linguistic traditions. We're going to sample some of those early languages when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Thomas Dubois, who's telling us about the confrontations, the encounters between Scandinavians and Celtic peoples during the Viking Age. An important part of knowing, or at least having some idea of what was going on back in the early centuries, pre-1000, is these court poets that you've mentioned. We don't know how exactly accurate they are in terms of literal history, but what part do they play in this whole thing?
Well, they were the official memories for these kingdoms or for these monasteries. They were the ones who said, here's our past and here's who we are. And so their poetry was extremely important. And one of the really interesting things about the British Isles, as well as Scandinavia, is that there's a very early desire to write down materials about the pre-Christian past or the early Christian past in the vernacular. Right. And the reason for
not
that
in Latin,
is
but in the local language.
Not in Latin, but in the local language. And part of the reason for that is because the materials were poetry, and it's hard to translate poetry into Latin from another language. And so that court poetry system, I think, gives us the reason why we actually have textual materials that allow us to reconstruct some of the events that happened in this period.
So this is different from what we would get maybe a little later, this tradition of religious poetry, this devotional poetry.
Well, interestingly, it starts as the same thing, but that's where those permeable monastic units are really important, because they were monasteries that were kind of open doors. So a young person could go to the monastery in teenage, learn to read and write, hear about the great verities of the Christian faith. But then they would leave the monastery and go out and have a life in which they got married, had lots of battles, had lots of the ups and downs of secular life, and then they would retire back to the monastery in old age. So they had this period of being out in the world, and they expect that the entertainment that they're going to have in the evenings at the monastery reflects that experience.
So it must have more depth in some way than if they had been isolated all
exactly.
their life.
Exactly.
Now,
yeah.
These court poets that you're – before we hear you sample them, would they be functioning – sort of as almost like PR spin doctors, you know, promoting a certain court because that's where they're employed?
That's spin doctors is a really good term for them, because I think in a very real sense, all kingdoms and also monasteries are vying for good talent, and their advertisement to the world is in poetry. So a good poem gets remembered and gets performed in other places too, and people say, "Ha-ha, that king has great nobility in his court. I think I'll go there." So they are magnets. It's an advertising device. And also, it is a way in which certain poets make a job for themselves and for their children and for their grandchildren, because these court poets are often in family lines. So they have a vested interest in keeping poetry going.
And do you have a sample you can give us of sort of early court poetry?
Yeah, I can give you a really interesting example of a work that's called Avra Cholamchile, which is the elegy for Columba when he dies. So he's in this monastery in off the coast of Scotland. And dies around 575. And when he dies, one of the other monks creates an elegy for him. So here's a monk who probably came from a noble family himself. We know his name, Donald MacFergal. And he creates a poem that is, on the one hand, mentions Christian elements, but on the other hand, is also very much in the tradition of the aristocratic elegy of the pre-Christian period. And so I'll read you just a little bit of it in modern English, and then I'll read you the Old Irish for that same part. And you can hear how aggrandizing of this monk, of this abbot, it is. So he writes, or he states, "Not without news is the land of the O'Neill clan. No slight sigh from one plain, but great woe, great outcry. Unbearable the tale this verse tells, Cullum, without life, without church. How will a fool tell of him? The prophet has settled at God's right hand in Sion. Now he is no longer left to us. Nothing is left to us. No relief for a soul, our sage." So in Old Irish, "Ni drishkol dwe neil, ni uchtat oin maegye, mor merig mon yelev, di falang rish re as indet, colum, ken bech ken chil, ko inja dui do, in fach de, de desion suidiach, is nu nad maer nad maherlen, ni les an ma Arsui.
I like it in the old Irish. Now, is that, would that be called Gaelic too?
That's, well, of course, there's the nationalism, right? So the term Gaelic gets used in modern sense usually for the form of language of the same language that was spoken in Scotland. And Irish people prefer to use the term Irish for things.
And what are the important characteristics of, you know, you just read us a little bit of the old Irish. What is unique to that language that would be different from the kind of language that the Vikings would have spoken?
Well, it's a Celtic language, and I think one of the fascinating things about it, and anybody who learns modern Gaelic or modern Irish knows all too well, is that whereas Old Norse or Latin or a lot of other Indo-European languages put their grammatical difficulties at the ends of words and all those endings that you had to memorize.
Yeah, right, right. Those declensions.
Declensions and stuff. In Celtic languages, those are put at the beginning of the words in changes you make to the first consonant. And so that makes it really very confusing for a speaker of another language. But if you had a word like bosca, that means box, in the box is savoska, where it changes to V, and then on the box would be Eremoska, which changes to an M. And these are very systematic, but they're hard for people to understand who are coming from another language. So it's a really interesting conundrum for the Irish monks to figure out how to write that system, because they're taking a Latin orthography and trying to adapt it, and it's really unbelievably convoluted the ways they come up to do it.
But, speaking of Irish monks, I was rather charmed to hear one description of the discovery of Iceland to the effect that it was discovered by the Norse in, the 9th century?
Yes.
And completely unoccupied except for a bunch of Irish monks.
Yes.
You know, wait
absolutely.
A minute. Who discovered the place?
Right. It's one of the one of the other aspects of this really distinctive Christianity that the Celts developed, that these monasteries, when they got ready and had extra guys, would send them off. And they would put them, as the texts tell us, in a boat without oars or rudder and off into the sea. End up where you end up. God will take care of you and you'll start a new colony there. And we have this, we find archaeological evidence of this, and there is this particular island off the coast of Iceland called Pape, where this Papa is the old Irish word for priest. And it's pretty clear that that was a place where there were Irish monks that ended up drifting there and starting their own colony. And for a long time, Icelandic archaeologists said, yeah, they were there and then they died off because they were just a little monastic community. But more recent archaeological evidence shows that they were more than that they also had a very established Christianity going on in that part of the world, and that they were also going out to find new settlements and creating new places to live.
So does Iceland become Christian fairly quickly once the Norse arrive? It doesn't sound like it would work quite that way.
Well, Iceland is discovered in 874. That's the traditional date that's given for it by a Swede. And then excess population from Norway and from Western Denmark very quickly starts to migrate there, but also excess population from the British Isles, where these Viking settlements have been developing now for 100 years, and a number of generations start to migrate up as well to get new land. And it's clear that the bunch that come from the British Isles have already become Christian, and they bring Christianity with them. But according to the saga accounts, when they get there, they forget about their Christianity. They set it aside, and the new country of Iceland becomes kind of rigorously pagan until the year 1000, when there's enough Christians and enough Christian pressure from the newly Christianized Norway that the Icelanders decide to adopt Christianity.
And do you have sometimes conflicting sagas or accounts where you take the same battle or the same event, but you're seeing it from two different sides and hearing it told a different way?
Well, we definitely have that with the Battle of Clontarf, which is a really important battle from 1014, in which we have the Irish side of the story, because this is the battle that ends the life of Brian Boru, who's the High King of Ireland at the time. He's managed to unite against their will these separate Irish kingdoms into a single unit, and he's managed to create a unified Ireland for a space of maybe 10 years, and then there is this battle, and it all falls apart, but it's remembered in a very particular way. And then we have that same battle being talked about in, for instance, Orkney Inga Saga, which is a saga about the Orkney Islands, which is written in Iceland. And it has its own version of that story and what happens. And it's wonderful to be able to teach, for instance, both sides of the story, or to look at these two different accounts and how they get memorialized in very grandiose ways by different writers.
So we have not that clear an idea of what happened in that battle that took the life of Brian Boru?
We have different versions of it, and it's an interesting one, because one of the things to think about is that the text that we have from Ireland, which survives in the text called the Book of Leinster from about 1160, so it's about 100 years after the events, and it's probably written for the benefit of one of the grandson or the great-grandson of Brian Boru. It talks about the Vikings or the Scandinavians as the great enemy. But at the same time, it mentions that Brian has set up very close relations with the Vikings of Dublin, and in fact has married the wife of the former king of Dublin, and has married his daughter off to Cedric, who is the prince of Dublin. So there's intermarriage being talked about in that text too. So we have it gives us evidence of two very different stories, but really interesting to look at the way that gets dealt with in the text.
We heard a sample of Old Irish. Do you also have a sample of Old Norse?
Well, I can give you an example of another elegy. And it's one by another court poet, but this is a Scandinavian court poet, Egil Skallagrimsson. And Egil is somebody who is born in Norway. He eventually goes with his family to Iceland, but he spends some time in the British Isles as well, has a lot of adventures there, gets a lot of notoriety, which is important in his kind of self-presentation back in Iceland. And then close to the end of his life, two of his sons die, and he's asked by his daughter to write an elegy about them. And he gives one, writes one, and it's very famous in Scandinavian literature. It's called Sonatorek, the grief over sons. So I could read you just a little bit of that one. I'll read you it in English first, and then in the Old Norse. My tongue is sluggish for me to move. My poem's scales ponderous to raise. The god's prize is beyond my grasp, tough to drag out from my mind's haunts. Since heavy sobbing is the cause, how hard to pour forth from the mind's root the prize that Frigg's progeny found, born of old from the world of giants. And here this wonderful kind of image. It's hard for me to talk about my grief, or to give the wisdom that I have from ancient times, from ancient sources. And in Old Norse, it goes, Mjök erum trekt, tungu at hreira, met loptvet, ljot pundara, eis enu vinlit of vider stufl, ne hogdreikt or huga fugsni, eis a oithfestur, tvi ekki vendur, höfudligur, or hygju stad, fagna fundur, frigja nidja, aur borfin, or jötum hemum.
Have other languages changed as much as, say, English in that period of time? Old English, totally incomprehensible after 1,000 years.
Yes. Well, Irish also changed a tremendous amount during this period. And in the Scandinavian world, it's interesting because Iceland preserves a form of the Old Norse that modernizes but is much closer to the old speech of the Vikings than anywhere else in Scandinavia. So the language develops into Norwegian and Swedish and Danish and changes a great deal on the continent. But Iceland somehow preserves something that's very close to the Old Norse.
Something to do with isolation, no doubt.
Absolutely, absolutely. And having a small enough community that you pass on the traditions very closely. And I think that's one of the things that's really important to realize is how a smaller community can maintain its body of traditions more easily than a larger one. And so that becomes a factor in what happens.
And is any of this poetry set to music the way, you know, the ancient Greek epics might have been done to a lyre or to some...
We find archaeological evidence of small harps in both sides of the story. And we also have lots of references to harps or some kind of stringed instrument being used. But we don't exactly know how they were used or what the music sounded like. And there's all kinds of interesting ways to reconstruct what that would have been like. Did the poets actually sing their verse or did they declaim it? What we do know is that they tended to be performing these in a large hall where people had been drinking a lot and that they probably had to shout them somewhat. And they're amazingly complicated verse forms that have all sorts of rules about assonance and rhyme. And so they must have taken tremendous amounts of concentration to understand. And so that kind of persuades me that they must have been declaimed in a very clear manner, because otherwise people wouldn't have any hope to understand them.
Good way to develop your public speaking ability is to shout at a group of half-drunken listeners.
Yes, yes.
More on the Celtic-Scandinavian encounter in the Viking Age when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Thomas Dubois, and we are talking about the encounter between the Celtics and the Scandinavians during the Viking Age. We've mentioned that the Vikings did a lot of raiding in Ireland. What did the Irish have to say about the Vikings?
Overwhelmingly, they talk about the Vikings as people of the sea that are foreigners that are don't belong here and that are important to get rid of.
Did they see them as devils or in any kind of religious terms as sort of the infidels? Or
they didn't really talk about it. Well, in a certain way, maybe I can illustrate that by actually reading you a little bit of what that one text about Brian Boru tells us. It's a medieval text called Cogach Goel Regalev, or the battle between the Irish and the foreigners. And it describes this Battle of Clontarf as kind of the highlight, the ending of the whole saga. And it describes the Vikings in a very, very negative way. And I can read you actually that description. It's just a wonderful example of the way in which storytelling and the poetics of storytelling also transferred into prose as well. So it goes this way. Now on the one side of that battle were the shouting, hateful, powerful, wrestling, valiant, active, fierce-moving, dangerous, nimble, violent, furious, unscrupulous, untamable, inexorable, unsteady, cruel, barbarous, frightful, sharp, ready, huge, prepared, cunning, warlike, poisonous, murderous, hostile, Danes.
That's quite the list of adjectives.
Yes, right. Bold, hard-hearted Denmark folk, surly, piratical foreigners, blue-green, and pagan.
Blue-green.
Yes. Without reverence, without veneration, without honor, without mercy for God or for man. So there we see this image of them as pagan, even though at this point the Vikings of Dublin are Christians. And they have been for a good 100 years. Still, there's this discourse about them as the pagans.
And the blue-green, is that because they're from the sea or because of their eyes or what is that?
The blue-green is an interesting thing. It might be because of the sea, and it might be that what the author is referencing is the notion of the Picts, who were said to have painted their bodies before battle. And he's just lumping them all together as a thing that foreigners do, a barbarous, foreign, painted kind of folk.
Do you think the invasions of the Vikings actually helped in terms of creating a sense of national identity? If you've got an enemy, if you've got an invading alien force, it perhaps forces people who would have been in separate little kingdoms to come together?
Absolutely. And you unite against a common enemy. And that is something that then historians or poets celebrate in their texts, that we came together and we repulsed this foreign element. It isn't what really happened. We can tell archaeologically, we can tell from the folklore of Ireland that there's a tremendous amount of borrowing and exchange and hybridity that results. But it makes a good story, and that story is one that later scholars in the 19th century and the early 20th centuries found very, very appealing, because to them it was important to create, for instance, a unified Irish history that would be different from the English history and that we were one people, not 150 different little warring kingdoms. And the same thing was happening in Scandinavia and Iceland and Norway and Denmark and Sweden. All of those countries wanted to celebrate past for their own nation. And so the Irish show up in the sagas or the Scots as magic workers, as dangerous, untrustworthy folks. And going back to the story that you started with, Norman, about the thistle, King Håkon is said to have come to the British Isles with his troops to put down an insurrection that was going to threaten to remove the Hebrides from his kingdom of Norway. And at the end of some successful battles, he has to figure out a place to spend the winter. And he's invited by Irish allies to go to Ireland. But his men so distrust the Irish that they say, no, let's not go there. Let's stay in the Orkneys. And there he catches a really bad cold or some other disease and dies that winter. So it's there is this distrust that is part of that story.
Now, how does this all play out in 1066, where you have these Francified Norsemen coming down and attacking an England, much of which, if not all of which, is under one king?
There's two battles that happen in 1066. There's, really interestingly, the one that we think about as the Norman Conquest, which is the English fighting against the invading Scandinavian Frenchmen under William the Conqueror coming over. But there's a one that happens about 2 weeks earlier, the Battle of Stamford Bridge, where one of the Norwegian king comes down and says, I'm taking back over this island because it's ours. It belongs to the Vikings or belongs to Norway. And so there is this, we can see the Norman Conquest within a much larger geopolitical struggle that's going on. If we go back to that metaphor, the game of Risk. This is one of those places on the board that gets traded back and forth really violently.
Well, now
over
we've got
time.
Relatively big armies going back
yes.
and forth.
Yeah.
And but the Norman French, you say, had a claim to England. I mean, it wasn't just like we're going to come down and take over. Wasn't there some intermarriage enough that there was actually a claim that the Duke of Normandy had to the English throne?
Well, Of course, the history that we have there is told from the Norman point of view.
The winners get to tell the story.
Yes, the winners get to tell the story. And his claim to the British throne was pretty tenuous by most modern readings of the story. But, of course, he won. And that does completely alter the history of England ever after.
And he won in part because there was a distraction of the other battle, right?
That's exactly right. The English army
couldn't run back and forth fast enough to cover both.
His great opponent, Harold, has to first fight a battle in the north against this other Harald who has come in from Norway, and his men are tired after that battle, and they have to rush down to Hastings to meet this invading army of Normans there, and it doesn't work out well for his side, yeah.
And as you look at these, you know, three or four centuries, the Viking Age and all the encounters going back and forth, what do you take away sort of from a modern point of view? Are there lessons there? Are there things that you find really startling or meaningful?
Well, I guess, the when I think about why this topic interests me so much and what we think about nowadays as early 21st century scholars, globalization and the way in which mobility is affecting people's lives is a really important topic. And it's fascinating to see that it was a part of the early medieval world too, and that cultures were on the move. People were finding new societies. They were creating new kind of hybrid societies, and they were exchanging ideas and so forth. And exploring that aspect of the history of both the British Isles and of Scandinavia, I think, is really appealing. And it's something that has been underemphasized in both fields because of kind of the important work of the late 19th century and early 20th century of nation building and of celebrating specifically national traditions.
So what would be the Viking imprint on Ireland and Scotland? I mean, England, they just kind of took over and obviously had some considerable influence there, but these outlying areas, what was the Viking impact or legacy?
Well, I think that one of the first impacts is clearly that the Irish realized that they needed to consolidate and that they learned how to consolidate as kingdoms from the example of the Vikings. And so it kind of pushed them towards that and also gave them an example of how to do it. And then when we look at Irish culture, there's a lot of elements that really come from the Vikings. And even the words we use, the word for boat in Irish is bald, which is a loanword from Scandinavian. And a lot of the technology having to do with fishing or with any kind of seafaring is, in fact, brought into Irish culture from the Scandinavians. So, in fact, those elements become what we think of as Irish culture today.
Well, thank you for joining us for this hour of University of the Air. Tom Dubois, always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Any positive samples from the literature that we could hear as we end?
Well, I think there's a line in that description of this wonderful battle of Clontarf, where we have such a conflict between what seem to be two very different sides. But the writer says, "And there was fought between them a battle, furious, bloody, repulsive, crimson, gory, boisterous, manly, rough, fierce, unmerciful, hostile, on both sides, and they began to hew and cleave and stab and cut, to slaughter, to mutilate each other, and they maimed and they cut comely, graceful, mailed bodies of noble, pleasant, courteous, affable, accomplished men on both sides there."
So at least they're acknowledging that it's
yes,
both sides.
Yes, and in fact they did that because they know very well that the society that they've built after this is a hybrid between both sides.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.